I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martine also helped to launch the car navigation system Geostar and the satellite service provider PanAmSat, which was sold to a division of General Motors in 1995 for $3 billion. Martine lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You are trans a lot of things. I'd like to start with your trans corporate life.
Okay.
You are a pioneer in the satellite industry, and it all started in the Seychelles, strangely, in a group of islands off of Africa. Can you describe the linkage between your discovery in the Seychelles and your career?
Sure. I really had no idea of what I wanted to do in life when I was in the Seychelles. In fact, I'd read a Newsweek article that this was supposed to be an idyllic set of islands where you could just catch fish literally with your hands and drink coconut milk. So I dropped out of UCLA and went traveling over there, feeling just really oppressed by the LA environment. So I get to the Seychelles, but it was really pretty dirty. I rented a small hut. Every night the floor would fill with gigantic cockroaches, but I was there, so I just, you know, hung out and did the best I could. One day, one of the Seychelles friends I met asked me if I wanted to go with him up to the NASA tracking station. I didn't even know there was a NASA tracking station. I went up with him, and there it was like I stepped into another reality. I went from like the past to the future. Everything was super clean and shiny and high-tech looking with blinking lights. And a very nice NASA engineer gave us a tour and explained what they were doing. And I asked him, why is this antenna that you have so humongous? Because it was bigger than a house. And he said, it's because the signals that we're tracking from deep space probes are so faint, they don't even have enough energy to light a light bulb. So we have to have a humongous collecting area in our giant satellite dish to receive the signal. And I asked him back, well, what if the satellite signals were very, very strong and powerful? He said, well, it's not possible to launch those type of satellites today, but if it was, then our receiving station could be very small and tiny. And the idea dawned in my head that if I could figure out a way to launch a powerful satellite, then everybody in the world could have their own tiny satellite receiving dish. Mm-hmm. I made a beeline back to UCLA. It's like I received a kind of quasi-religious epiphany in the Seychelles that I was going to connect the world with satellite communications, and this was a technologically practical thing to do. Mm-hmm. So I went from having a C average at UCLA to straight A's because I had a passion that I was going to be the world's expert on satellite communications.
You were in your late 20s.
Correct.
Were there other examples in your life of, you know, having the moxie to say, you know what, I'm going to transform something? What were examples of that in your childhood?
My transformative examples were from biographies and also from science fiction. I was fascinated with the Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov series of books. And those examples of people who transcended their background to become, you know, the man who purchased the moon and people who went to Mars, those books inspired me.
Your mother always thought there was something unique about you, but I just thought, well, you know, welcome to being a Jewish mother. Did you ever have a sense of self that kind of extended beyond what you thought other peers experienced?
No, I didn't. I really felt myself pretty much a totally average person and lazy and usually trying to figure out the way to get something done with the least amount of work.
And how about your parents?
My parents were hardworking and great people, but my dad was a dentist for the Retail Clerks Union, so he had kind of like a 9-to-6 job. My mother was a speech pathologist at San Diego State College, so she would go there and teach each day.
What in your mind was the most pioneering or innovative experience you had in the satellite realm?
One of the, to me, the most remarkable stories is when I was running Sirius, one of the business plans was to get the major radio stations to major radio networks to invest in Sirius and to put their content on our satellite network. So I went to see Mel Karmazin, who was at that time the CEO of Infinity Radio Network, which hosted the Howard Stern Show nationwide. And I went to Mel and I did my satellite radio pitch and I said, this is going to be the future. Everyone is going to listen to satellite radio. And he laughed at me and he pivoted on his desk to his credenza and he said, you see these piles of paper here? He said, these are audience research reports that I commissioned to find out what the audience listening to each of our radio station thinks, what their demographics are, what their age is, how many of them are. He said, now, how high are those piles going to be the day you launch your Sirius XM radio system? I said, well, on the first day, there'll be nobody listening to it. He said, exactly. He said, Martin, get a real job. So the funny coded...
Fast forward a few years later, and who becomes the CEO of Sirius?
Mel Karmazin, yeah. And I loved having a chance to recount the story to him when I was on the Howard Stern Show. He remembered it. But it just goes to show... What he was saying was not incorrect, but my vision for Sirius was pay radio. And the whole paradigm of regular radio was commercial advertiser-supported radio. So it's an entire paradigm shift that had to be promoted.
What else surprised you about launching a service like Sirius? Was it the regulatory hurdles or?
I expected there to be regulatory hurdles. That process always involves taking the radio frequencies away from somebody else. So there's always an adversarial process involved. But what has surprised me with Sirius, to this day, I would say more people come up to me and thank me for providing Howard Stern and other content to them via Sirius, then people come up to me and thank me for saving their children with the medicines that we produce at United Therapeutics.
Mm. What does that say?
I think it says that information is very, very important. In fact, there's a quotation I've heard that says, information is the necessary, if not sufficient, basis for development.
You left Sirius and you found yourself in another industry, the pharmaceutical industry. And I purposely used the passive because it didn't seem like an active decision to go into the pharmaceutical industry just on the face of it. You have a daughter, Genesis, whom you discovered has a disease, a pulmonary hypertension disease. And she's the one who came up with the idea that you launched this company. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's true that my first love and actually most lasting love is space technology, satellite communications. If I could snap my fingers and sort of like, you know, reimagine the whole universe, I would be right back running either Sirius XM or probably even like a Elon Musk SpaceX type of company. But the fact of the matter is that I love my children, and my youngest daughter, who is just a beautiful, simple child, gets diagnosed with this life-threatening disease, pulmonary hypertension. There were no medicines available, so it wasn't a matter of thinking about it. I just went to the library and began doing research.
Now, you mentioned you went to the library, but it was you and she who would go to the library
we
together.
Would. That's true.
7-year-old Genesis.
Yes, we would together. She was very, very helpful, and I would say to her, I know there was an article by Dr. Rich, and she would say, wait a second, and this is Stuart Rich, a physician in Illinois, and she'd look through the pile of Xerox copies of articles and say, here's the Dr. Rich article.
You launched United Therapeutics with your own capital.
That's correct.
From Sirius. The drug, which later got FDA approval, was developed by a gentleman, James Crow.
Correct. There was a gentleman, Dr. Crow, at GlaxoSmithKline, who had a solution for pulmonary hypertension, a new medicine, but Glaxo would not let him develop it because the patient population was too small. And GlaxoSmithKline had recently purchased the Burroughs Wellcome Company. Burroughs Wellcome was a very old line pharmaceutical company, and they would develop things whether they were profitable or not. So SmithKline, Glaxo, bought them. And when they bought them, the first thing they said is, we are not pursuing any more of these, fairy tale dreams. We have a filter. We will only pursue drugs that promise $1 billion or more in revenues, which are called blockbusters.
You got hold of Dr. Crow's telephone number?
Yes.
And called him?
Yes, cold called him.
And what was his posture towards you originally?
Great skepticism. How is somebody who is a satellite CEO going to develop a medicine? How are you going to get it out of a pharmaceutical company? I'm very sorry about your daughter, but there's nothing I can do to help you.
Miss Martin Rothblatt, upon hearing that, that probably just put more fire under your belly.
It did. I was actually, he did me a great favor by doing that because I was pretty much back to the Martin who was galvanized by the dream of uniting the world with satellite communications. And I said, now, you know what? I did something like that. I can do this. Yeah. I can do this. And coincidentally, at the very same time frame, people sent me two movies to watch. One was Lorenzo's Oil. There was a story of a father trying to save his son by doing things that pharmaceutical companies wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And another was the, to me, the archetypical entrepreneur movie called Tucker, about this man who invented the seatbelt, the parabolic headlight lens for cars, the shatterproof glass for windows, who after World War II tried to create a new type of automobile called the Tucker and was beaten down by the big three automakers in Michigan.
United Therapeutics is public. You became the highest paid female CEO in America. Upon FDA approval, the stock price went up exponentially. And how do you navigate that? What does that mean exactly?
So what it really means is that my compensation is tied to our stock price.
So this was as of 2013. And you're not somebody who really revels in the public light. What were your reactions when media was coming to you because of this fact that happened almost accidentally?
So it's basically a kind of embarrassment, at least in my own personality. I don't try to be the center of attention. But I do realize as a public company CEO, every element of my compensation is publicly disclosed.
And by the way, when I first read that fact and the fact that you were previously a man, I thought, seriously, the highest paid female CEO, of course, has to have had been a man.
I feel that that's unfair, too. I agree with you. I tell you the truth, I had exactly the same feeling. But I do know in other years, the highest paid female CEO had always been a female. So I'm sort of like the exception that proves the rule.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martin Rothblatt. We'll hear more from Martin coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Martin Rothblatt, a pioneer in the satellite and pharmaceutical industries. She's the founder of Sirius Satellite Radio and United Therapeutics, a public pharmaceutical company initially focused on treating cardiopulmonary disorders. Martin lives in Vermont. She's a helicopter pilot and a parent of four children. She also used to be a man named Martin. United Therapeutics is public, and your annual reports, I think they're kind of
different.
Unconventional. You tell me about them.
So our annual reports are different. One of our annual reports was in the form of a graphic novel that told the story of a new employee. Another of the annual reports was in the form of a children's book. It was patterned after Goodnight Moon. It was called Good Year UTHR, that being our ticker symbol. Another of the annual reports is in the form of what we call a periodic tablecloth of utelements. So we make an annual report because that's something that's legally required, but there's no rule that says your annual report can't be a children's book.
The company now is extending beyond just hypertension, and I'm intrigued by your focus on xenotransplantation, which is basically taking animal organs and surgically putting them into human beings.
Correct. Although the real trick there is to first genetically modify the animal organ so that it will not be rejected when it's put into the human being. And we formed a joint partnership with Craig Venter's company, the man who decoded the human genome, called Synthetic Genomics is the name of his company.
Why focus on a pig versus another animal?
So it's an odd quirk of nature that of all the animals in the animal kingdom, the animal whose organs match the size and shape of humans better than any others is the pig. Even better than chimpanzees, by the way.
Now, this is somebody who grew up in an observant Jewish household. Were there any even irrational just reactions that you might have had when you first discovered this?
You know, the good thing about all religions, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, is they really are very rational within their own belief system. So Judaism, like Islam, like Christianity and Hindu, believe that the sanctity of life rises above all other things. By the way, I did my PhD thesis on xenotransplantation. I interviewed rabbis, imams, people from all the different religions, and it turned out that all of them said, we accept the transplantation of animal organs, pig organs in particular, mm-hmm. into bodies. So it's kosher. It's halal. It's okay if it's being done to save a human's life.
You have a pig farm in Vermont. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Right. So the name of the pig farm, it's called Revivicor. What's grown there are pigs that already have several genes knocked out. We now be having modified the first few genes of the pig. Our organs, when they're placed into a person, last from months to as long as over a year now at the NIH. In fact, my mantra to the company is inspired by JFK's mantra when he said, I want to land a man on the moon and safely return them to the Earth before the end of the decade. I tell people in our company that we want to transplant a xenolung into a patient and return that patient safely to health before the end of this decade.
You're a helicopter pilot. Is there any connection between wanting to get your helicopter license and this endeavor?
As most people know, when organs are donated for transplantation, they're generally transported by helicopter because you only want to have the organ outside of a bodily system, outside of blood and whatnot, for a short period of hours. So to avoid traffic jams and to go over long distances, organs are usually transported by helicopter or plane from location to location. I'm also a fixed-wing pilot as well. It would give me a great sense of completion of accomplishment to be able to personally deliver one of our first sets of xenolungs to a waiting patient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the founder of the pharmaceutical company United Therapeutics. Martine is transgender. She became a woman in 1994 at age 40 after having had sex reassignment surgery. I want to talk about your transgender life. How has this physical change changed the way you feel?
That's a really tough question to answer, especially, you know, briefly. I think the answer that really bubbles to my mind is, as being core and essential, is that I've always felt like a woman. So I found myself, as I went into my teenage years, identifying with the women in the room where I would be instead of the men in the room. Yet I was totally obviously aware that everybody considered me a boy and then a man. And I was totally aware that when somebody deviated from those socially accepted roles, that they were sanctioned, they were laughed at. I didn't want to be laughed at. So I kept my feelings of being a woman tightly bottled up inside myself because I didn't really want to be laughed at.
I would think a man who understands women would be very attractive to women. Did you have girlfriends? And
I did. I mean, when you're talking about like sexual orientation side of being a woman, my sexual orientation has always been to women as a woman. So if I was to give it a label, it would be a lesbian label. Yet I was faced with this contradiction that I had the body of a man.
What's an example of, you know, you're identifying with the women in the room?
I'd say, like, if there is a topic being faced in the room and one group of people are kind of hard-edged about solving the problem and the other group of people are maybe like, maybe there's a way we can massage the situation, I just naturally go to the massage the situation.
In 1995, you wrote a manifesto called The Apartheid of Sex, which demystified or criticized the classification of things by gender.
That's correct. And My point of view was that was really based on the research that came before me, specifically Professor Anne Fausto-Sterling from Brown, who had written that there are not two sexes. There are actually multiple different sexes. She discovered, for example, that it's not as simple as saying women have two X chromosomes and men have an X and a Y, because there are people born with two X's and one Y, two Y's, one X, all kind of variants in between. But in most cases, these intersexualities were not so manifest that they were observed by surgeons at the time of birth. So nobody said, oh, this is an intersex child.
So these are genetic mutations.
Yeah. I would say it's part of the natural diversity of human life. And so that got me thinking, well, if there's all of this fluidity in the body, there must be just as much fluidity in the mind.
You said that separating people by gender is similar to separating blacks and whites, which,
of course. And by the way, when I wrote that, it was considered like crazy. Mm-hmm. But now in Germany and a couple of other municipalities, parents can decide not to stamp male or female on a child's birth certificate. Mm-hmm. And the idea of being gender queer, basically self-defining one's own gender, has gone from being, you know, totally on the margins to, I would say, for people who are like millennial generation, it's beginning to be like, you know, a thread of that culture.
Speaking of race, your wife is African-American, Bina Aspin. You married her in 1981 when you were a man, and it was a surprise to her 10 years later that you wanted to undergo this sexual reorientation. Mm-hmm. How long were you thinking about this before you actually mentioned it to her?
Well, I would think about it the whole time because I've been transgendered feeling since I was a teenager. So I thought about it the whole time, but it was something that I thought just had to be bottled up forever. And fortunately, there were pioneers who came before me in the 1970s and 1980s, people like the ophthalmologist Renee Richards, who also became a tennis star. And I read other biographies of transgendered people who had come out. And there's a judge in Houston, Texas, Judge Phyllis Fry. So these people gave me hope and inspiration that maybe I could come out as well.
And her response?
Her response was immediately open. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, my God. There was never an oh, my God. It was, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really interesting. That's fine with me. I love you for your soul, not any part of your skin.
And she calls you Martine. She's Martine sexual.
And I feel my identity is being a sexual.
Your children, talk to me about your approach to them. And I'm curious as to the array of responses.
Sure. Well, all four of them were very accepting. And I'm eternally grateful to them for that because so many other transgendered people I know have horrible situations of being disowned by portions of their family. And so I said to each of the four kids that this is what I wanted to do, change my sex to female, but I would not do it if they objected. And each of them had a very different response, perhaps reflecting their various ages. The oldest was my son, Eli. He was about 20, okay? And he said, it's your life, Martine. You have to do what you want to do with your life. He was a student at Johns Hopkins at the time. The next oldest was Sunny. She's a fashion designer here in New York City now. She was at that time about 18. And she said, lots of my friends have two moms or two dads. I don't see anything so strange about that. So it's really interesting that she saw it in a totally different way as just like now she has two moms.
That's right.
Whereas I've actually never really tried to be the mom. They still call me dad, but that's how she saw it. My son Gabriel, who was in junior high at the time.
Hardest, probably.
Yeah, it was the hardest. And he said that friends would tease him. And he said he only wanted to know would I still be his dad. And I promised him, Gabriel, I'll always be your dad, no matter what. And he said, okay, it's okay with me.
I read in New York Magazine that you said, well, I'm going to be like a butterfly.
Yes, I did say that. He has four children now. And they call me Grand Martine. And then the youngest, yes. Genesis, she was quite young. She was 10 years old. And she was actually the one who outed me to my own parents because she told them, you know, Martine has these women's clothes that she and mom wear when they go out places. And then my dad and mom asked me, is this true? Why would you do this? But Genesis said, well, it seems to me just I love my dad and she loves me.
Hmm.
And it was just remarkable how she just switched the pronoun and made the whole thing make sense.
That's right.
So she said, okay.
And your mother?
My mom said, look, we could have had two daughters or a son and a daughter. It doesn't make any difference to us.
I've noticed sometimes in this interview I'm confusing pronouns and things like that. Does that get under your skin?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. I'm like totally flexible with it. And in fact, it's kind of an interesting recherche test to me. Just going out with strangers, some people say ma'am, some people say sir. It's almost like 50-50. And it's kind of really interesting. But I'm like, as long as, you know, you call me Martine, I'm happy.
See, you have the mind of a woman. Like, so understanding.
Thank you.
Was marrying an African-American woman almost equally striking to people at the time?
It was pretty, it was shocking to some people. Mm-hmm. This was less than 20 years after it was illegal for people to marry people of different races. The Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia was decided in the 1960s. So it was, our kids were teased. Our oldest son, Eli, said kids at school would call him a zebra. So I think it was analogous.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Martine Rothblatt, the highest paid transgendered CEO in America. Martine is also transhuman, launching efforts to extend human life and achieve immortality through biotech and artificial intelligence. Her most recent book, called Virtually Human, The Promise and Peril of Digital Immortality, is written with Ray Kurzweil, the lead engineer at Google. Could you describe briefly the thesis of your book?
Sure. A lot of the top engineers in Silicon Valley have been working on creating cyber consciousness, allowing things like Siri to develop greater and greater capabilities until they're really personality operating systems. So what always intrigued me about that, perhaps because of my legal background and I have the PhD in medical ethics, what are the ethical consequences of creating consciousness in software? Do we have the right to create consciousness and consciousness and then just turn it off?
Now, your hope is to, if I'm speaking correctly, you know, being transhuman is to bring immortality and life extension to people both in the body but also out of body through things like mind clones.
Well, that's right. I believe that the purpose of the biotechnology industry in general is to keep people alive longer. So Ray Kurzweil was, I think, the first person to ask, well, when does that end? You know, if you ask yourself that question, you realize that there is no ending point, that as long as somebody values their life, we all would like to keep that person alive as long as possible.
So what will happen to your body when it dies?
When my body dies, it will like, you know, well, in the case of me in particular, it will be frozen at a company called Alcor in Arizona, what's called cryonization.
And how about your digital self?
My digital self will, I believe, be, after a span of some years, be activated as a mind clone of my flesh brain and will continue a life in cyberspace.
Now, when you say a mind clone of your flesh brain and be in cyberspace, I think you lost listeners there.
Sure.
A little bit. What is a mind clone?
Mind clone is if you take all of your digital reflections of yourself, which you've uploaded to the cloud and to servers in your computers, all of your Facebook postings, all of your likes, all of your blogs, all of your photos, all of your Instagrams, if you take all of that, and then you purchase some software called Mindware that elicits the personality evident in those uploads. And you combine the two, you end up with a mind clone of yourself, a software version of your mind that has most of your memories, feelings, recollections, and beliefs, and also has your characteristic expressions, mannerisms, and how you think.
Now, who wants to be around Martine's mind clone? Do you think your wife, your kids? Who else beyond that?
No offense. Yeah, no problem. I think my friends would also want to be around my mind clone. And I would also want to be around their mind clone.
Where would you live? Where would the mind clone live?
The mind clone would live in the cloud and presents itself wherever there's a display
And by the way, I'd be curious about my mind clone because, you know, I don't know myself enough to know what that mind clone would be. Are you kind of curious about what the outer manifestation of yourself is beyond what I see in front of me?
I think there'll be lots of books written about with titles such as 10 Things I Learned About Myself from My Mind Clone.
You live in Vermont, and you have started this organization called TerraSim, which is devoted to life extension. And I think of Vermont as being bucolic, and here you have this, you know, uber futuristic endeavor. And it reminds me of your experience at the Seychelles, which I have not been there. Also, in my mind, seems like a, you know, placid bed of islands, yet NASA was tracking satellite systems behind a closed door.
Correct.
Do you think about that dichotomy in both places?
I do. I think that Vermont is very bucolic and beautiful. On the other hand, Vermont is also a place where there are a lot of great scientists and information technology. IBM has a major center there. University of Vermont has one of the nation's most advanced gene sequencing machines. So there's a lot more technology going on in Vermont than people would expect.
What is something that I might not know about you? We're talking about how you're trans a lot of things.
One thing you might not know about me is that I have not purchased a ticket on a rocket ship ride around the Earth, and I have no interest in doing so. My feeling is that the Earth is the greatest spaceship in the universe. We can see almost all the different stars, certainly in our own galaxy. As we travel around the sun, we get a different perspective of the entire sky. In the meanwhile, we're perfectly comfortable. We can breathe the air. We can jump and swim and fly in the air. So I treasure above everything else, Spaceship Earth.
Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Martine Rothblatt. Coming up, we'll meet Jonathan Seder, co-founder of BioLite. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Seder, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean, portable stoves for cooking off the grid in developing countries as well as for camping. The stove reduces toxic smoke emissions by 90% by using its own heat waste to generate energy. BioLite is targeting a global public health challenge of smoke pollution caused by cooking over an open fire. According to the World Health Organization, more than 7 million people die annually from smoke originating from open cooking fires. A USB port on the stove can also charge a cell phone or other portable device, which is useful to the more than 1 billion people who own cell phones but lack electricity. Jonathan graduated from Dartmouth College. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does the BioLite stove work?
Sure. So the BioLite stove is a wood-burning stove that recaptures the waste heat and turns that heat into electricity using a technology called thermoelectrics. Thermoelectrics are kind of like solar panels for heat instead of light. And we take that electricity and use it, essentially cause the smoke to reburn.
So how much smoke is the stove actually generating? If I'm looking at a stove and it's burning, am I seeing smoke?
If you see a car driving down the street and there's smoke coming out of the tailpipe, you would say to yourself, that's a badly tuned car. And if you look at an open fire or any sort of wood fire and there's smoke coming out of it, it's the same exact thing. It's a badly tuned fire. What we're able to do with our technology is take that 10% of really nasty stuff and turn it to 1% of really nasty stuff.
You mentioned wood is used to fuel or to start these fires of these stoves. What else can you put in these stoves?
Obviously wood, but also agricultural residues, so, you know, crop waste, corn stalks, that kind of thing, cow dung as well, dried cow dung.
Prior to starting BioLite, you worked at a firm or a company called Smart Design, which helped companies like OXO, which sells kitchen appliances, or Staples, to create innovative products. And it was there that you came up with the idea for a camping stove with your co-founder, Alex Drummond. You worked on this for more than 3 years before you even incorporated as sort of a side project. Did you have sort of an aha moment where you finally got this technology right, or was it more of a gradual process?
No, there was definitely an aha moment. So the project started nights and weekends, and it was really Alex's initial idea. His brother had given him a small wood-burning can with a battery-powered fan on the bottom of it. Alec and I are both pretty avid outdoor folk and campers, and this seemed like a great alternative to bringing those nasty petrol cans out on the trail. And there was this one aha moment in Alec's industrial loft in Dumbo, Brooklyn, where we had built this funny little bent sheet metal thing. I remember us sitting in his loft, and it's smoking, and it's not lighting, and it's not generating electricity, and, you know, we're really scratching our heads, and Alex's poor wife and daughter are, you know, choking in the other room on all the smoke we're making. And I can't remember which one of us, but one of us realizes that the wires were disconnected, and we touch the wires, and all of a sudden this smoky mess turns into this purple mushroom of clean fire, and, you know, we did this sort of inventor's high-five dance, and from there, I think we knew we were onto something.
This idea started off as a stove for camping, given your enthusiasm for the outdoors. At what point did you realize, you know, this market could be a lot larger if we address the need in developing countries?
Yeah, so after about 3 years of nights and weekends tinkering, we had what we called a looks-like-works-like prototype, right? So something that really demonstrated the potential in what we were working on. And we took it to an advanced wood combustion conference, if you believe that that exists, in Seattle, and two very unexpected things happened there. One,
this is the Ethos Conference?
This is the Ethos Conference. One, Alec and I were introduced to the fact that half the planet is still cooking on smoky open fires, and that those fires kill more people than HIV and TB and malaria combined. And two, we entered our funny little prototype into their clean stove contest, which they have every year. And we won the cleanest stove of the year, and we were the only stove that wasn't plugged into an electric wall outlet to achieve those levels of emissions. And so it was this incredible confluence of, wow, this really is an important problem, combined with, we have a very unusual and promising solution that this industry had not seen before.
You mentioned it was at the conference that you learned the global scope of this problem. And here you are, a kid from Manhattan and Scarsdale, so you didn't necessarily have much exposure to the developing world prior to this. Is that right?
No. I mean, prior to this, I had been to India once as a tourist. I had seen people cooking on open fires, but quite frankly, I had never imagined that such a prevalent practice was at the root of so much suffering.
I remember my husband and I, we were in Jordan in the Middle East in the Wadi Rum Desert, and we were sleeping in a very large tent one night with these Jordanian Bedouins, and they cooked dinner using an open flame, but that fire was actually inside the tent. Mm-hmm. And my husband, whenever we think about that trip, he's always like, yes, do you remember that night where I couldn't sleep from the smoke pollution? Is it just an education issue that people don't realize that the smoke is so bad for them? Why build the fire inside the tent, for example, versus outside the tent? You've seen that too?
Absolutely. I mean, this is how half the planet is cooking. Specifically, why inside the home? Convenience. Right? Protection, safety, comfort. It's very hard to tell people how to live their lives differently. I think the best thing that we can offer is ways to participate in existing practices and make them safer and more convenient.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite, a company that produces clean biomass-powered stoves that allow clean cooking and electricity access in more than 70 countries internationally. So going back to the early days, once you decided to focus on both camping stoves and stoves in the developing world, how did you go about convincing retailers to adopt these stoves? Were there one or two that were key in this acceptance?
So in 2009, I left Smart Design to go refine the business models and raise venture capital. And I moved out to Berkeley partly to work with development economists and people focused on this issue of indoor air pollution. It turned out to be a very serendipitous time to be in that sector. In early 2010, Hillary Clinton launched the Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves and used our technology as an example of innovation in the sector. So there was really this burgeoning interest. The U.S. State Department became interested in clean cooking and started to put some funding towards it. And so it was a very fertile time to be starting this business.
Accidentally. The timing worked out well.
Completely accidentally. I also spent about half of that year living in India as part of a social enterprise incubator called DASRA, where I was the only American company. It was me and 24 other Indian social enterprises, and it was a wonderful education. I understand campers. I shop at REI. I go camping on weekends. I don't understand what it's like to, or at least certainly at the time I didn't, understand what it was like to cook in a village, to buy things in a village, to deliver things to a village. So those two experiences combined really helped me refine what the business model was to a point where we could take this thing that sounded kind of crazy initially and actually put some venture capital behind it.
One of your early investors is Clayton Christensen, who is the author of Innovator's Dilemma. He's a professor at Harvard Business School. In a way, you are living that innovator's dilemma because you have these large incumbents who could produce these stoves, but just the infrastructure and the inertia and the entrenchment of these companies just causes them not to focus on this, whereas you don't have that burden.
I think that's right. I do think when we've seen larger companies like BP, like Philips come to the market, they bring all of the baggage and history from where they're coming from. And so if you look at BP, for example, when they tried to solve the cook stove problem in India, they said, great, we'll be a fuel company, right? So we'll sell these stoves at subsidized rates at a loss, and then we will, through selling biomass pellets, pay the stoves off over time. Well, turns out BP is very good at selling gasoline. BP is not very good at sourcing agricultural waste from 1,000 smallholder farms, turning those into pellets and moving those out through a rural distribution channel. And that's nothing wrong with BP. That's an incredibly hard thing to do. But we weren't burdened with those kinds of presumptions coming into our market.
What were some barriers in the cultural arena that you didn't foresee?
Sure. Oftentimes, one of the biggest barriers to women adopting clean cookstoves is that it's not valuable to their husbands. You know, men are typically controlling the finances of these households. This is an expensive product. Like, there's no two ways around that.
So is it roughly $40 a stove?
Yeah, that's about right.
And these are people who are making $2 a day or varies?
It's a very wide spectrum, but I would say from $2 to $10 a day. But what we have very interestingly found is that the fact that our stoves generate electricity engages men in the cookstove question in ways that men never have before. And it's very funny. If you look at our village demonstrations, there are typically more men in the circle than women, and that is unusual for a cookstove.
Because of that USB connection to their cell phones.
That's right.
What about the smoke? I mean, we instinctively say, oh, yeah, smoke is a bad thing. But what is the reaction of these people who don't see much smoke coming out of the stoves?
Well, my favorite quote that I've heard a number of times in the villages is, well, where did you put the smoke? The conversation isn't so much this is going to change your health over a 20-year time horizon. That's not really what's compelling. What's compelling is I can save you time. I can save how much fuel you're using. I can keep your eyes from watering while you're cooking. I can keep your house cleaner, right? A sooty wall is the sign of a less developed household, that we can really provide these aspirational qualities, which are the same reasons you and I purchase 90% of the things that we buy.
Fashion. Right.
Fashion. Well, yet, fashion and function and convenience.
What is some pushback that you've witnessed? For instance, in Myanmar, some people said that the stove was too small. It seemed like a toy.
Well, so this was interesting. That was a test that we ran in 2009. We said, great, we can use this camp stove to solve a huge world problem. And so the first thing we heard was, well, I'm not going to break my twigs up into a million little pieces, and this doesn't cook for a family of eight. And I think that's when we started to understand, okay, it might be one technology, but it's not one product.
Because the stove was too small for a family of eight.
It was too small, and it didn't cook with the wood that they cooked on.
And how about between countries? So while you ultimately might have gotten a cultural acceptance in Myanmar with a bigger stove, why might it not work in India?
So there were certain things that needed to be different, right? So in India, it needed to cook chapati well, which is a thin flatbread that gets cooked on this kind of conical dish called a tava. And we found for a while that our flames were too concentrated in the center, and so they would burn the chapati, and we needed to find ways to diffuse the flame better. In Ghana, the staple food is called banku, and it's this very glutinous, starchy thing that you stir with a huge, heavy stick, and they actually use bent rebar that they stand on to hold the pots from tipping over while they cook. And so we needed to make sure that our stoves could work with that. But what we've actually found is that, by and large, our stoves work fairly well for most of what you would have normally done over an open fire. People warned us that, you know, you need a different stove for every community, and that's not what we found. And, you know, I think it's unsurprising that it's not what we found, because if you look at what most people in these communities aspire to use, it's LPG, liquefied petroleum gas, so, you know, gas. And gas burners look about the same everywhere you go, and anyone who has enough money and lives in a place where that's accessible uses that.
I want to go from Ghana to Washington Square Park in New York City. There was an introduction to the public of your stoves after Hurricane Sandy. How helpful was that with the PR and raising awareness of what you were doing? And,
sure.
And what did you do?
I was actually stuck. I was stuck in Seattle. I was planning our launch with REI, and a couple of our engineers took it upon themselves to take a bunch of inventory out of the office and set up tables in Washington Square Park and then in front of City Hall and then out in the Rockaways and make people tea and charge their cell phones. And it was really interesting. Even in a city with as modern an infrastructure as New York, we realize how vulnerable we are and how dependent. And the biggest pain point that people found was that they couldn't charge their cell phones and tell their loved ones that everything was okay. With a device as small as ours, you were able to cross that kind of minimum energy threshold.
You mentioned REI. It's an outdoor camping store. How important was REI in all of this?
REI has been a phenomenal partner for us. So they came to us at about the same time we launched online in 2012 and said, we want to launch you guys at retail. And we spent close to a year planning what became the biggest stove launch they've ever had.
I want to talk about your personal life for a minute. You live in Brooklyn.
I do.
In fact, you ski to work sometimes.
I did cross-country ski to work one day this winter. It was definitely the best day of my winter. If it was up to me, it would be winter all the time. It's a little bit weird running an outdoor company here in New York City, but I've always been passionate about the outdoors. I went to college in New Hampshire and worked as an outdoor educator for a couple of years after college.
On a ship, you spent a year as an engineer and a teacher where you taught navigation skills, basically, operation skills on a 135-foot ship?
Yeah. So after college, I was recruited to be the engineer for an oceanographic research program that ran 150-foot ships across oceans, running the engineering facilities of the ship. So the propulsion engines, the refrigeration, the electrical generation, the water makers.
Now, did you have an interest in the sea? Here you were, a kid from the suburbs, or was it kind of incidental that it happened to be the sea? It could have been trains.
No, I really loved sailing little tiny dinghies as a kid on a lake near where my grandparents spent a lot of time.
What do your parents do?
My mom is a pediatrician and my dad is a corporate lawyer.
Were you always tinkering as a kid?
Yeah, I drove my parents nuts. I broke everything in our house trying to fix it. But growing up, my uncle would give me tools for every birthday. So, socket drivers and all this stuff. And I'd go out to his house and he'd allow me to strap the leaf blower to the skateboard and buzz up and down the street. So, yeah, I was always very mechanically curious.
David Kelly is kind of a grandfather in the product design innovation world. He started a company called IDEO and the Stanford D School. In what way was he influential for you?
I was bobbing around the Sargasso Sea and randomly pulled his book, The Art of Innovation, off of the small library that we had and started reading it. And
on this 150-foot ship?
On this 150-foot ship.
Okay.
It's a closet with some books in it.
Mm-hmm.
Started reading the book, and I think I was about 25 pages in when I started writing my application to become an intern at Smart Design.
You also play the banjo. Did you bring your banjo as you travel the world?
I did. I had my banjo at sea with me, and I have a mini banjo that I oftentimes take with me when I travel in India or Africa, and it makes for nice conversation.
Do you play the banjo while you're pedaling your stoves?
No, but that might be next year's marketing plan.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Jonathan Cedar, co-founder of BioLite.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.
Get your crew free yard and come railroad train.